As part of KGNU's ongoing coverage of equity issues during the pandemic, we spoke with a family physician in Aurora who operates a health clinic for refugees. Dr. P.J. Parmer runs Artis Family Clinic on East Colfax. He also owns and operates Mango House across the street from the clinic. P.J. Parmer.
Mango House is a shared space for refugee services and businesses. It started 7-8 years ago. I had opened a family practice right after I finished residency, seeing only refugees. And then after a couple of years of that, I wanted to have a building full of refugee services where other tenants were either refugees themselves or helping refugees. So I started Mango House in one location and then saw an opportunity to expand it to a larger building, which was right across the street at Galena and Colfax. So we did that a few years ago. I tried to sell the older building, wasn't able to do that. So basically now we are using both buildings across the street from each other and have dozens of tenants, including my medical clinic and my dental clinic, and the rest are tenants of mine. That includes 6 or 7 restaurants, dozens of stores, maybe a dozen churches or religious gatherings, and a number of other activities. At this moment, 100% of it is private business, small family owned, and except for my medical and dental, all the tenants are refugee owned small businesses.
Do the businesses pay rent?
Well, they do pay rent. So that's the key place where the support comes in. I try to charge them sub-market rent, and that comes in a few fashions. One is just their monthly rent. The other is it's easy to get in and out of leases. The other is I provide the majority of the build out for them. And I also sometimes sit there with them and literally help them file for their Secretary of State license and their MyBiz Colorado and their Aurora license and, you know, do the nuts and bolts with them sometimes. But many of them are able to figure some of that out on their own.
In terms of your practice as a family physician, how many patients do you see and who are they? Tell us who your patients are.
So in my family medicine practice, we see refugees and asylees. That's what we've been doing for almost 10 years now. We have probably 15,000 visits a year right now. They're from all places that Denver is currently getting refugees from and has gotten refugees from in the last 10 years. So Burma, Bhutan, Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Congo, Rwanda, Somalia, those are some examples. We do have some of the Eastern European, Ukraine, for example, and some refugees from further back, a few Vietnamese, a few Russian. So that includes all the sub-ethnicities too. So in the when I say Burma, that actually includes Chin, Kachin, Arakan, Rohingya, and even those have sub-ethnicities like Kachin Rawang, Kachin Lisu, and so forth.
That's an awful lot of languages to translate. Are there potential barriers there?
Well, about half of our patients actually speak enough English themselves, and most of the rest, they know well enough to bring someone with them to help. There's only rarely do we have people who come in totally without, and they're the ones who know that we hire some staff in our most common languages. So I have staff who speak over the years, or currently Somali, Nepali, Burmese, Karen, Arabic. And also we have a number of our tenants are like community leaders. So for example, our Rohingya grocery store, a lot of people trust him. He's basically a hub for the community. And he's even a somewhat of an imam, I think, at our masjid. So he ends up translating, and community navigating is what it turns into. And that's why it sure beats a phone translator, is because the phone translator is sitting in a different city and they don't know what King Supers is.
How are you able to make it work financially?
So this is private business, so we're not talking grants or donations. We're talking the same as any other family medicine office, which is called fee for service. We mostly have Medicaid patients or uninsured. A small percent do have other insurances, and a small percent of those pay us. Many of the private insurances don't even pay you these days, but Medicaid pays. And most doctors say it pays way too little to do anything with, but we don't find that to be the case because we're good at playing the Medicaid games. We know their systems really well, and we have a lot of process efficiencies to cut overhead and also to increase volume. And so the medical practice is profitable. The building itself, the Mango House, is not profitable at all currently, and it has not been, but that was never the intent. It's a place for me to sink the profits from the medical practice, turn around, put it back into the community. Although, give me a couple of years, Mango House itself probably will become profitable, and then I'll be looking for other ventures. Our dental clinic is about break even these days.
I'm going to ask you about the pandemic and the vaccines in a minute, but in general, the population you see, same health issues as the overall population, like the typical stuff a family doc sees?
Yeah, we're doing typical family medicine here. Sometimes people wonder, are we seeing hepatitis B and tuberculosis all day? And it's no, we sometimes have to think a little bit more about those things. And there certainly are mental health issues that go along with being a refugee. But for the most part, it's traditional family medicine. The adults have back pain and diabetes. The kids have wellness issues and like shots, and they have colds.
So when the pandemic came around about a year ago, what was the general attitude of your patients?
Yeah, at first there was a lot of panic, and I shouldn't try to put everybody in the same bucket, just as any of our American friends and neighbors have widely varying views on the pandemic. We've had the same thing. So we have some that were quite worried and coming in and testing. We opened up for corona testing right away, and we've done like almost 5,000 tests now. But we've had some who take it very seriously, and we have some who they think they never have it, or they're scared, or they think that if I put a swab up their nose, I'm going to give them it, or some other variation of that.
And mask behavior, same as what we've seen generally, with most people on board with it, but some adamantly opposed.
Exactly. And over time, increasingly, people have realized they just need to do it.
So fast forward to more recently, as the vaccines became available, tell me about your thought process and what led to your decision ultimately to say, you know, we're prioritizing vaccination for refugees.
Well, the reason we were able to get the vaccine soon enough, in my opinion, is related to, this is a minor issue, but it's actually pretty significant. We've been doing publicly funded vaccines for years. We're a family doctor office that sees Medicaid kids, so we get what's called vaccines for children shots. So we were already set up with the state in that regard. It was not a new thing to us to manage those sorts of vaccines. We, just like many family doctors' offices, had actually closed during the pandemic. I didn't realize that till later. We never closed. We were doing corona tests and managing patient needs for that. So of course, the opportunity to do corona vaccines was high on my priority. And we, until now, have been open only to refugees and asylees, but I saw it as a moral responsibility to open up to the greater, poorer neighborhood. In fact, it was actually a state requirement to open up to everybody who needed the vaccine. And I thought, well, fantastic. I wanted to open up to the neighborhood, but let's open up to everybody. So we did that. And in fairly short order, one satisfied customer from the suburbs told 50 others, and our waiting room was overrun by people driving in from far away who were realizing they could come get the corona shot. And that was taking us away from doing our refugee work very immediately, directly. And I really don't know how else to say that. I was not doing refugee work anymore. I was not doing underserved medicine anymore. And that happened like in the course of a week. And so I said, we got to do something about that, because I need the time to educate the folks. Our refugees, the people who have vaccine hesitancy or who maybe don't trust or maybe don't understand or even know the systems, they require a little bit of different finesse. And so I didn't have the time of day to deal with that because we were helping an overserved population. So I just said, forget about it. We're serving only our local zip code, 80010, which is the poorest zip code in the metro area, and in addition to our existing populations.
In terms of that education process with your existing population in the neighborhood, how did that happen? How does that happen? I'm assuming this is still ongoing.
Right. With our existing populations, we have many fingers in the refugee communities, and we try to work every one of those. So many of my tenants, just talking to them directly or talking to the leaders of the churches, the religious leaders, but also there's the adult daycares. That's a Medicaid benefit, which ultimately is a pretty big piece of the puzzle for community navigation for a lot of refugees. These are all the people who really do the community navigating, is the church leaders and the store owners and the adult daycare leaders. And so working through them to educate them, and also the VOLAGs, as it's called, the refugee agencies. I did a Zoom call with them recently, with their staff, trying to get them to all get on board and get the shot when they can, so they're all then able to educate their clients. The local community, 80010, we do have a couple organizations that I'm happy to partner with now. They're nonprofits, Aurora Community Connections and Rise Colorado, work with tons of Spanish speakers, including undocumented. We're happy to be giving their clients shots. I mean, when their turn comes, based on state criteria. But those are local organizations. There's also an organization popping up called Jesus on Colfax. It's a local pastor who's trying to do work with, well, homeless folks and prostitutes and so forth on East Colfax. And we're trying to work together to target some of those folks. But we also have some of the homeless that just literally, quite literally, sleep on my properties. So we're trying any way we know how, and also putting up signs, which honestly, I've never really believed that signs do much, because it's a word of mouth type of world. But I did order some signs and stick them up. And I guess I ordered a banner and I shouldn't have, because Aurora told me I can't have banners on this stretch of Colfax.
So you're trying to serve the population that you have a mission to serve. And when word got out that you're open to everybody and you had the vaccine, that overwhelmed you. So in order to basically focus on your core populations, you said, nah, sorry, we're prioritizing the refugee community and the people in our zip code, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And the whole zip code idea, it was not entirely foreign. It's something that is going on elsewhere in the United States, depending on the state and so forth on their decisions. It is something we're seeing done. So I'm not trying to discriminate based on color, not at all. I would not want to do that. But I would like to be discriminating based on socioeconomic status, because the virus has discriminated based on socioeconomic status. As we all know, it's hit harder the poorer you are, because the folks in this neighborhood where I'm standing right now, they can't social distance. Six people share a car. They ride together to the factory where they work shoulder to shoulder, and they couldn't get off from that job and Zoom from home for the last year. And they live 5, 6, 8 people to a 2-bedroom apartment, where some of them roll out a mat on the living room floor to sleep. They don't even have a bed. You know, the social distancing is a privilege in these neighborhoods. And so that's why, obviously, we've seen the harder hit, the harder impact, and the higher numbers of incidents and even deaths in these neighborhoods. And the virus discriminates like that. Of course it does. And so I thought we need a strategy that discriminates.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. PJ Parmar. He has a family clinic and other opportunities to serve refugee populations there on East Colfax and Galena in Aurora. So tell me, when you announced this, you know, hey, sorry, we're not open to everybody for the vaccines, we're prioritizing people within these populations, you got some pushback from the state. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we were doing it just fine for a month or so, and eventually the state did pick up on that, and they told us to stop doing it. And I asked them to put it in writing, so they did. They said you can't discriminate based on zip code. Now, I understand exactly where they're coming from. It sounds very good on paper from one viewpoint. Equality is, it's, you know, it's the kumbaya that the world wants. It's, we all want to be equal. That's obvious, but that's just, unfortunately, it's different from equity. And we even have a vaccine equity task force in this state. I don't know much about them or how they interface with the state, but anyway, what the state was commanding me to do was equality. They said open back up to everybody. And I tried telling them, hey, I did that, and I was not doing underserved medicine anymore, but they actually wanted no discussion on the matter. So I tried reading up on what the state strategy was for underserved communities, and it's pop-up clinics, meaning one-time events, like maybe they partner with an Ethiopian church, for example, and they'll do 200 or 600 shots or whatever. And that's fantastic. But to me, that can be one great piece of the puzzle, but that's pop-up. It's like inconsistent. It's not there routinely. And what's wrong with trying to serve the poor people routinely? That's strange to me that we can't, that I'm being asked to not do that. I know no one's asking me to not do that, but the moment they ask me to open to everybody, that is equivalent to asking me to close to poor people, because it's not rocket science. When you put the same amount of food out there and there's a runt in the litter, all the rest are going to come eat all that food before the runt gets it. And not to use a crass term like that, but that's exactly what we have going on here. And it's not just a theoretical or academic thing. It's what I'm actually observing. The folks will sit at home in the suburbs on redial endlessly, isolated in their house. And the moment they find a place, have the car to come get it. Whereas lower income folks in these neighborhoods, there are 15 reasons they can't do that, starting with the phone, the car, the time off from work, and so forth.
So the state pushes back, says, quit doing that. You're not allowed. What did you do?
You know, what the state is asking us to do is to hide our identity, kind of put us in the closet. So they want me to, they said you can target low-income folks, or you can target a certain population, but if anybody else shows up, you have to give it to them. So that feels kind of like a don't ask, don't tell to me, like we're not going to really admit that you're doing underserved medicine here. So, all right, we're going to be open to everybody, I told my staff. We're open to everybody again, all colors and all comers. In addition to that, well, for all callers, we're going to make an appointment, which might mean a wait list. In fact, it probably does mean a wait list, which, as you know, is how the majority of the 800 vaccine sites in the state are currently running, is with a wait list. So we'll be the same as everybody else. But in addition to that, if they're from 80010 or a refugee, they can skip the list and get a vaccine right now. Now, of course, I haven't heard a response to that strategy, or maybe no one at the state has picked up on us doing that, but they might come back and say, nope, that's not doing it equally. So we'll cross that road when we come to it.
Yeah, and just so our listeners are clear, although you have prioritized your refugee population and your zip code, you are following the priorities set by the state within those populations. Is that correct?
We've been on 1B3, and 1B4 is starting next Friday.
How busy is it? I mean, how many people have you vaccinated thus far?
We might have done a couple thousand doses. That includes many second doses now, because it's a two-dose series. We're maybe pushing 100 a day, which is not where I thought I'd be, but there's a few very good explanations for that. And the main one is the 1B3 versus 1B4 issue. And that's because a lot of low-income folks work in manufacturing and grocery, and Abuelo is in Mexico. What I mean is, the older generation may not be here. And that's the ones who've been higher on the priority list until now. That's where the category one, whatever it was, 1A or something. So, and we know that there's been plenty of writing about that, that the first rounds to get them were mostly a white population in nursing homes, so forth. But for example, Aurora Community Connections, Rise Colorado, they both tell us to expect a tremendous amount of people starting with the next category, which is this Friday. And we're looking forward to that. I'm looking forward. We're ready for it. We have the staff. We have the space. We have the doses on hand, I think.
I was gonna ask you, how's your supply?
Well, at first when we started, which is now 6 weeks ago or so, we did not have a steady supply. The state, in fact, was canceling our orders and diverting them to the large, events at the stadiums or what have you. And I managed to get the ear of one person at CDPHU who was sympathetic, and she diverted some doses to us. And since then, we've had pretty much what we asked for, exactly what we asked for, which has been wonderful, except our last order from a week ago, for some reason, was not approved. And we've seen this sort of thing. This is what happened 6 weeks ago, too, where we don't get straight answers. And I can't tell if it's because of the weather or, you know, they're overworked because they got 800 sites. It's very understandable. There's a lot going on. Or if somebody's doing it intentionally and didn't tell us, like in a passive sort of way, we never know.
Well, one thing that has become clear in this conversation to me and in our interactions setting up this interview is you are extremely busy person. You're seeing patients, you're trying to run this facility for small businesses, and now it appears, based on what you said, you're also having to kind of defend your decision to prioritize this population and sort through red tape, et cetera, et cetera. How's that feel?
You know, it's actually a familiar situation. There's been a number of things over the last decade where I've found tremendous barriers to doing underserved medicine, believe it or not. The government would have you believe there's one way underserved medicine's done, and that is through what's called federally qualified health centers or community health centers. And even that's quite a challenge. But to just do it as a private doctor, that no one does that. No one sees mostly Medicaid and uninsured folks. It just doesn't exist. And when it doesn't exist, you're foreign to the system. You come in at a different angle, and often you end up being seen as a threat. And so I have countless number of places where similar things have happened over the years where I'm having to stand up for the poor people, but that's exactly why I went into this. And so I love that aspect of it.
What is at the root of your commitment?
Oh, a lot of racism from when I was younger. Pretty straightforward. I want to be able to be there for the person who's beaten down by whoever is doing the oppressing. I want to be able to stand up for them. And I know that I have the privilege to, because I walk in between two cultures. My family was an immigrant family from India. I grew up in this country, but I was definitely in an immigrant household. So I can sit between two cultures. That gives me a privilege of being American enough to help them navigate, but being foreign enough to understand where they're coming from. And also privilege of education. I feel it's my duty to do it. I wanted to help the least fortunate of the immigrants, and that's, of course, the refugees and asylees.
And you chose to do private practice to sort of go your own way there.
Yeah, I did not want to do it as part of a existing structure, because right or wrong, one great aspect of my personality is I just like doing things my way, which, I feel like I'm able to make progress quicker on a lot of things. I'm just a soloist like that. And also, I had a little bit of experience with some nonprofits doing healthcare, and it just was not my thing at all. It was very inefficient. And also the patients were not being served in as well of a manner as I would have liked to see them being served. The system was just bogging down on, like, in its responsiveness to them. It shouldn't be that the poorest have to go to the government-run health center which may be a place that's so unattractive that others choose to not go there. You know, those community health centers are open to absolutely everybody, but certainly the richer of the folks don't choose to go there because there's not aspects of them that are useful. If those aspects were there, they would be overrun by those other folks. But I do put those aspects into the work I do, which are things like 100% walk-in appointments, quick responses, you know, but being able to talk to their doctor fairly quick at any time, stuff like that. The customer service, the old town family doctor feel, which you can't get in a lot of places right now.
What would you like our listeners to keep in mind as this pandemic plays out and as there is a lot of talk about inequities in the system? What kind of action should we be looking for?
You know, the issue of who gets the vaccine first is pretty much going to be a non-issue fairly quick because we're going to have a ton of doses and the categories are going to open up to everybody like within a month. And it's going to be a non-issue. But this has been a great case study and it's a wonderful discussion on equity and what did we do? How do we do it? And why don't we have more places that we can focus on health equity instead of just shooting for equality as a minimum?
Dr. P.J. Palmer operates the Artis Family Clinic on East Colfax in Aurora, as well as Mango House, a shared space for refugee and asylee businesses right across the street. If you want more information, the easiest thing to do is to search on Mango House Aurora. Thanks for tuning in to listener-supported KGNU. The Morning Sound Alternative is next.